Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. When Dr. Baron Lerner decided to look at some of the changes between the ways he and his father practiced medicine, he was using his training as an internist, bioethicist, and medical historian, now at NYU's Langone School of Medicine. But reading his father's journals, he got a little more than he bargained for in terms of the changing role of the physician, finding out that the late Dr. Philip Lerner, for example, broke a lot of the rules that Baron's career is founded on. Baron Lerner's new book is The Good Doctor, A Father, A Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics. And he joins me now. Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
And first, tell us a little bit about your father and when he practiced in medicine and the environment of that.
My dad went to medical school in the 1950s and then did his fellowship in infectious diseases in the early 1960s and practiced until he got ill in the late 1990s. And this was an exciting time in medicine. There were a lot of great discoveries, particularly in his field of infectious diseases. You had penicillin, you had polio vaccine, and as a result, the medical profession had a lot of authority and the public viewed it in a very positive light. And what went along with that, as I learned as I was doing my research, was also what we might call some paternalism. So the doctors had so much to offer the patients that they felt in many cases that it was their job to make all the decisions and, if necessary, mislead patients to try to get them to do the right thing.
And you say that growing up during World War II, the Holocaust played a part in his decision to be a doctor. What part and how did that inform his approach to medicine?
My dad was a second-generation American. All his relatives had come over. His parents had come over from Poland, and all of them had been working class. So he was really the first college-educated and first doctor on any side of the family. And he felt very strongly that he wanted to give back because he was so grateful to what his family had done. And then in 1945, when he learned about the tragedies of the Holocaust and that his family had narrowly missed potentially being annihilated if they had stayed in Europe, he became even more indebted to them and more intent on becoming a member of a profession that could give back to other people.
So he was Marcus Welby, M.D., since he was a contemporary of that model of what a physician is.
Absolutely.
So the main difference between how you and your father practice medicine, judging broadly from the book, is I think in the most stark relief with end-of-life issues, right? What did you find in his journals around those that surprised you?
Well, I start the book with a story in which a pretty jarring story in which he actually had a patient who was extraordinarily ill, and he thought it was time, if her heart stopped, that she should not be resuscitated. Now, she didn't have a DNR order, which is, again, one of these new ethical, legal rules that we have to follow.
DNR, do not resuscitate if the patient has written that down in advance.
Exactly. So this patient did not. And when this patient, who was severely ill and in a lot of pain and suffering, actually died, he placed his body on top of hers and prevented the other doctors from doing resuscitation. That sort of event, I can't even conceive of it happening today or certainly in any of the hospitals that I work in. And that symbolizes his paternalism and his inclination to try to do the right thing for patients regardless of the legal and ethical rules in place.
And listeners, we can take your calls on this, even from the little you've heard so far from Baron Lerner. Are you part of a multi-generational family of doctors? And if so, what changes in how medicine was practiced by your father's or grandfather's generation do you wish you could follow today or not? What's better? What's worse? Call us, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And this is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJO 90.3 Toms River, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJP 88.5 Sussex, New York and New Jersey Public Radio. So, Dr. Lerner, was the patient's rights movement in reaction to your father's and his contemporaries' maybe paternalistic way of approaching medicine?
Absolutely. The era that I described, in which Dr. Knew Best and Marcus Welby and Don't You Talk Back to Your Doctors, caused a reaction. And it wasn't just what my dad was doing, but more broadly, people have heard about the famous Tuskegee scandal, for example, and other questionable research projects and medicine. And basically, this was a societal reaction not only to medicine but to authority more broadly in the 60s and 70s. And patients' rights, as a result, became, much like civil rights or feminism, became a rallying cry for patients. And it was time for patients to make decisions and to push back against these doctors who were perhaps well-meaning but too overbearing.
So did your job, one of the jobs you do now as a bioethicist, even exist in your father's day?
No, there was no such thing. They all thought they were very ethical, and all you had to do was follow around an older ethical doctor and you got the ethics. And unfortunately, it wasn't that simple.
Are there upsides and downsides to where we've come? The easy conclusion is that reading your father's diaries, made you decide that it was way too simplistic that back then. Doctors had too much control over end-of-life issues, for example. But today it's also so fraught and complicated. And in a way, more leeway sometimes worked on behalf of the patients, whereas today everything is so carefully inspected and regimented. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think one of the saddest things as my dad's career was winding down, one of the things he always railed about was giving patients what we now would call today cookbook medicine or a menu of options. The notion that patients should make complicated medical decisions, particularly at the end of life when there's often a lot of distress, and the doctors wouldn't be involved in that except for doling out options, was just the sort of thing that was making him sort of crazy at the end of his medical career. And I think that there's been a growing realization that the pendulum probably swung too far in the direction of patients' rights as a reaction to this earlier paternalism.
Is that what you think?
Yeah, I do think so.
So give me an example of that excess and how it actually winds up hurting a patient.
Well, I think, you know, sometimes I think my colleagues and I could tell stories about patients who don't sign a DNR order. The doctors go and they talk, and it's often a relative who's been in the hospital for weeks, or they come from a nursing home, they have some dementia, and the patients and families are distraught. They don't want to take responsibility, and they say, do everything, doctors. But really, at that point, everything is practically futile. All you're doing is prolonging a death. And those are the cases that make us think that maybe we need to push back a little bit more as a profession.
It's interesting because for all the emphasis on the right to die movement, it almost comes in what? In contradiction, in conflict with the patient's choice movement, seems to be what you're saying, which you would think would be just the opposite.
It's complicated. I mean, different people come to this different ways. We've all, ironically, sometimes as doctors, we see patients where we think we should be more aggressive and either the patient or family is backing off too soon. So it's always going to go in both directions. You know, I think that the ideal situation is patients are informed and know about their rights, but at the same time, they try to work with doctors and nurses and accept some good, wise advice.
Baron Lerner, my guest on WNYC, his new book, The Good Doctor, A Father, A Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics. He's an internist and bioethicist at NYU's Langone Medical Center. And Nancy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Baron Lerner. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. I just wanted to tell you that I come from three generations of physicians and that my grandfather was a man who kept all the records of all of his patients on index cards wrapped in an elastic band in his back pocket. And I remember laying in the back seat of the car, he would go to people's homes, and then he'd come out and he would have done what he had done. And then my father came along, and the first thing he did was change everything in the office and tried to do it more AMA and traditional. But then when my father got very sick and was dying and saw the way things were working, he thought he had made a really big mistake and that he really went back and checked with my grandfather's sort of ideas, and they had some resonance to him. And now my brother is a psychiatrist and does everything legally straightforward on the computer, no questions left unanswered. So it's been a really amazing process to watch it work.
Is it progress?
I loved the way people responded to me when they knew that I was my grandfather's child, my grandfather's granddaughter. People were just hands-on, and they just adored me purely for the fact that they so held my grandfather in esteem because of his respect for them. I don't get that anymore, from the history that has come down.
Baron, you want to talk to Nancy?
Yeah, Nancy, those are great stories. I think that the reality is today that if I was walking around with cards in my back pocket and using that for documentation, I'd get in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
But the idea of your grandfather knowing his patients and going to their homes and almost carrying their information next to his body in some kind of almost a very meaningful way, I think is so resonant. Certainly, when I spoke to people when I was working on the book about my dad's career, I got these same sort of wonderful stories. One person at his after his funeral literally grabbed me by the shoulders to say how much his care had meant when her husband was dying.
Right.
That hands-on type of approach.
Nancy, thank you very much. But I'm wary of false nostalgia too. And for the individuals who somebody with a personal touch may have touched, can we say that the outcomes on balance were better in that day? Maybe all the record keeping now, not because of insurance company demands and things like that, but maybe the meticulous record keeping, maybe the privacy. I guess that's what you were reacting to with keeping a card with their information in his pocket. Maybe these things on balance work more for more patients, even though some of these beautiful moments and stories get drained.
I think so. I'm worried about being a little too nostalgic. And a funny story, I was talking to another doctor, and I was saying I was working on a book of my father's career, and I said my dad had really good clinical judgment. And this doctor started saying, "What do you mean by clinical judgment? How do you prove that?" So touche. But, I think in an era in which we can get all this information and transmit it from doctor to doctor and hospital to hospital, that's clearly an advantage. And the old days are gone. What I tried to emphasize in my writing here was to try to restore some of that personal approach, even in a world that's dominated more by computers and technology.
Catherine in Queens, you're on WNYC with Baron Lerner. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
All right.
So I am actually in my first year of residency. I'm just finishing up as an intern right now, and I come from a family where both my parents are doctors. Mm. I just wanted to say that in terms of residency, at least, I feel like there's so much more accountability now. And so literally it's better for patient safety that attendings are around all the time. There's a lot more attendings that are in the hospital all the time. But in terms of decision making, I feel like doctors of my generation are coming out with less good clinical judgment and decision making capacities because there's so much oversight to prevent medical errors right now.
So why does the oversight create worse clinical judgment? Why wouldn't it create better clinical judgment because they keep getting feedback about where the parameters are?
Right, that's true. But you're never making the decision on your own, and so it's a very different learning environment. So you're constantly learning how to make decisions how other people would make them and not necessarily, there's a lot of opinion in that, and it might not always be the best, or what might not be what you're reading, in the articles or in the literature as being the best for the patient.
Dr. Lerner, talk to Dr. to be Catherine.
I'm going to push back a little bit and say you're probably doing a better job than you think. When I was writing, certainly my own experience, I was right on the cusp where I did do some of those 110-hour weeks and 36-hour days, and my dad certainly did that. And there was a chance to learn at the bedside in a crisis situation. And I did learn an awful lot of medicine that way. But I was also exhausted and crabby and that sort of thing. And these days, it's harder, I think, because you're not immersed in it as much. But I think that being awake and alert, having a less crazy work week, and, you know, going home and reading after you see your attending do something and asking questions and having a dialogue, I think you're actually probably learning almost as much as we did in those days, and you're much better rested.
Right. I am much better rested. I cannot ever complain to either of my parents about my work hours.
The days of the Giants.
They had it exactly.
Even in her residency.
yes.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you very much for your call. By the way, Baron Lerner's previous books, if you know this name but are trying to figure out why, One for the Road, Drunk Driving Since 1900, he wrote that history book, When Illness Goes Public, Celebrity Patients and How We Look at Medicine, The Breast Cancer Wars, Hope, Fear, and Pursuit of a Cure in 20th Century America, I did that 10 years ago, and Contagion and Confinement, Controlling Tuberculosis Along the Skid Road. Unfortunately, your next to most recent book, One for the Road, Drunk Driving Since 1900, kind of hit home very personally for you recently. And I wonder if you would talk about it, because you did write a recent column drawing on your personal loss to suggest that it's time to see reckless driving as a crime, like drunk driving itself is now. And you're related to that poor kid who got hit on the Upper West Side in January, right?
Yes, Cooper Stock was my nephew. He was 9 years old, and he was killed. A cab ran into him January 10th. And so it's been a devastating time for my entire family. Ironically, as you said, Brian, I had written a book on drunk driving, so I did have some knowledge of issues of traffic and safety that I immediately thought of when Cooper died, and wanted to try to use somehow the expertise I had gained to try to help others not get into Cooper's situation. And certainly my sister and brother-in-law have been doing the same sort of thing. And the point I made in that piece was that I think these days we see drunk driving as something that obviously would be a crime. Right. And how could you drink and then go drive? And that has to be a crime. And the point I made in the book was that 30 years ago, before MAD and the other organizations, people took drunk driving not seriously at all. And they said these were accidents. People were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And it struck me as I read about my nephew's situation, and indeed just last week we learned that the driver is not being prosecuted, that it was almost analogous to drunk driving. And our society, for complicated reasons, has given a pass to people who kill people when they're driving.
Why analogous to drunk driving? Was there, in your opinion, a sort of willful recklessness on the part of the driver, but there's no crime category for it, or just no will to enforce?
I think the people, smart people who know about traffic, are working on trying to redo the laws in this exact reason. I don't think we could say willful recklessness. I think that he wasn't paying attention, and it was a rainy night, and there had been another crash in the area, and cars were honking their horns, and everybody was stressed out, and he drove into the intersection. Into the crosswalk where my brother-in-law and my nephew were crossing legally. He just drove into them because he wasn't paying attention, and my nephew died as a result. I just don't understand how we can live in a society that can basically shrug its shoulders and say, too bad, we really feel bad for you.
Kathleen in Putnam Valley, as we return to the question of different generations of doctors practicing differently. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. I'm calling because I'd like to comment on some of the changes in medicine that have caused dissatisfaction, not only for patients but for physicians as well.
And your son is a doctor, right?
Yes, he has a concierge practice in Connecticut.
Which means?
Which means that he sees probably about 10% of the number of patients that a doctor in traditional practice will see.
Does that mean concierge practice? Does that mean he's dealing with very wealthy patients who are paying cash?
No, that's what's interesting. They're not very wealthy patients. Some of them are, but many of them are people who have made a decision that they're rather than taking an extra cruise this year, they're going to pay to have a personal physician.
Okay.
And that permits him and his partner to spend many, many hours sort of behind the scenes, checking with other doctors who are involved in the case, making a home visit, doing research on the particular condition. And I haven't heard Dr. Lerner talk about this issue of the number of patients that doctors now must see in traditional practice, why he thinks that has increased so greatly, and what he sees as some of the alternatives, of course, including concierge practice.
This cuts right to the heart of the problems of medicine these days. I mean, the reason doctors, including myself, have to see so many patients is purely financial, right? So I'm getting pressured to see 9 patients morning and 9 patients in the afternoon by my hospital because they want enough volume, and doctors in private practice are the same thing because reimbursement rates are low, et cetera, et cetera. Concierge medicine is one small part of a larger solution, I think. For people, as you suggest, who can afford it, it potentially brings back that old-time hands-on medicine because the doctors are seeing fewer patients and they can put the resources to this sort of thing. I think pretty much everyone, I'm sure your son would agree, this unfortunately is not a solution to the larger issue of you know, people who are uninsured and people who can't afford that sort of thing. To the degree that it models a system of patient care that's very intense and patient focused, it's an aspect of something we can strive for.
What does Obamacare change with respect to any of this, if anything, before you go?
A complicated question. You know, I think Obamacare potentially, by standardizing insurance coverage and by focusing on things that patients need to get and getting a basic sort of group of interventions together is a step in the right direction. What it doesn't do is give doctors more time with patients. If other people in the team besides doctors can take over some of the responsibilities, which we're trying to do, nurse practitioners and social workers and nurses, and potentially free doctors up to do more doctoring and being involved with direct discussions with patients, that's a good potential advantage, but that's still a ways down the road.
Dr. Baron Lerner, his new book is The Good Doctor, A Father, A Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics. Thank you so much for a good conversation.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Douglas Rushkoff up next. Stay with us.